And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studio right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Well, it looks like the clown show may almost be over. Trump was just acquitted of both articles of impeachment by a vote of the Senate. And after the way Pelosi showed her ass yesterday, I'm wondering, is there going to be repercussions from that? She is no longer the queen. So we'll have to wait and see what comes of it. Now, yesterday, we were talking about Noah's Ark and the number of people who either from the ground or from the air had seen what most people believe to be the remains of the Ark. There was a investigative trip to Ararat in August of 1985. And the individual who did it interviewed Captain Swinghammer and other former pilots of the 428 Tactical Flight Squadron to ascertain whether some of his memories of the icebound ship on Ararat coincided with other sightings. When he was asked, what did the other pilots think about what you and they had seen, he said, we used to talk about it in the bar after flying. Some of the pilots thought it was the Ark, and others didn't know what to think. I wasn't convinced about that, but I knew I'd seen a large rectangular building like a barge or a ship high up on the mountain. He was asked how far away from the object were you when you saw it, and he said, we were coming down from 5,000 feet. I think we're more like 3,000 when we sighted it. I remember we're doing 380 knots. The Turkish liaison pilot said that's where Noah's Ark's supposed to be. Look, you can see it now. He estimated he saw it at a 45-degree angle. Appeared to be hanging at 45 or 30 degrees down the mountain. When he was asked, did anybody take any photographs, he said, no, we're in too much of a hurry. We had 2 hours of fuel. It took us 45 minutes to get there in the F-100. We had time enough to make just one pass around the mountain and return. We had to be careful. The Russians had a radar installation right on the border. C-130 had recently been shot down. The pilot was a guy named Dick Skidip. He was asked, from your memory, where was the object on the mountains? And he said, well, you can tell approximately from the map. The point where I placed the Ark we saw was at about 4,000 feet from the top of the southeast slope, perhaps 4 o'clock from due north. He was asked if he thought it would still be visible, and he said, I think most of the time it's covered with ice and snow, and well, we just saw it at that time when part of it was protruding from the snow. I know I saw a rectangular structure that looked like a ship. It was at a period of time or history, and we were there at that time. Other pilots in the squadron remember having taken part in flights over Ararat or having heard that other pilots had seen a ship-like object on the mountain. Lieutenant Colonel Ben Bothrop, then a first lieutenant, said, I was a deputy base commander at the time. Swinghammer was there at that same time. A Turkish pilot told us the Ark was on the side of the mountain. Seemed logical to me. We took a bunch of flights around the area looking at castles and ruins, and on the Ararat we saw something different. About two-thirds of the way up the mountain, made of wood and looked like a boat or a wooden boat-shaped wall. I don't know who first said it was Noah's Ark. We all discussed it. Most of us felt it could be, since that's where it was supposed to be. Captain Lloyd Hawkins was interviewed, and he said, I was assistant squadron commander and heard about the incident at the time that it happened. I didn't put too much faith in it at the time, and I clearly remember hearing about some pilots seeing something unusual on the mountain. Colonel Robert Phillips, who was then a first lieutenant, said, I was rotated through Adana with another squadron. I heard rumors talking to people at the bar about some of the pilots having seen the outline of something looking like a big ship or a barge on the mountain. I didn't get a chance to see it because they told us to steer clear of Ararat, not to go near it because of what happened to the U-2. Colonel J.L. Pennington, who was a first lieutenant at the time, said, we used to go on trips from time to time, and sometimes we went hunting for wild boars. I do recall some pilots in the squadron said they had seen Noah's Ark, but that was so long ago. Colonel Bradley Telshaw, who was a second lieutenant at the time, said I was on one of the flights in the area. I remember seeing something, an unusual outline on the mountain, but I couldn't be sure what it was. People think they've seen the Ark have occasionally made sketches of it or instructed artists how to draw what they had seen. An unusual coincidence occurred when William Carus, Ararat explorer and senior minister of Probe Ministry, sent Captain Swinghammer's a booklet called The Search for Noah's Ark, describing search activities on Ararat and difficulties encountered in 85. The book contained a sketch of the Ark made by Alfred Lee, a longtime Ararat explorer, under the direction of an eyewitness. The eyewitness, an Armenian named George Hagopian, an ex-shepherd, claimed to have climbed up to the Ark in 1905 at the age of 10 and had seen it on several other occasions. According to Hagopian, he had even walked along the roof of the giant ship. Swinghammer, who had never previously seen the picture dictated to Lee, had independently asked one of his acquaintances to draw a picture of what he had seen. The two pictures were essentially the same, the Ark banked in the snow, the position of an outcropping of the mountain, and even the shape of the barge or ship, with the exception of openings along the top of the structure seen from the ground, but too small to have been visible from the aircraft. The pilot and the shepherd, unknown to each other, had seen and described the same ice-bound ship, evidently at a time when it was partially visible outside the ice. Although it's intriguing to find that separate viewers have sketched similar pictures of the Ark, the lack of photographs and the fact the photographs have subsequently disappeared is a recurring disappointment to researchers of the great ship. Some of the mysterious disappearances of photographs lend a James Bond-type flavor to Ark investigation. 1952, an oil engineer named George Jefferson Green, a passenger on a helicopter reconnaissance flight for an oil company, flew around Mount Ararat. Green said he noticed what seemed to be a large prow of a ship emerging from the ice. This was on the northeast side of the mountain where so many sightings have occurred. On his orders, the pilot maneuvered the helicopter to points as close as 100 feet from the object, during which time Green used up a roll of film on the unusual object. When he developed the photographs, he found that they showed a ship-like form located in a gully between a high cliff wall and a precipice, partially receding into the snow or glacier in back of it. In other words, he essentially photographed what had been described by other viewers. Allegedly, the pictures had been taken from a close enough distance to show laminated planks on the ship's hull. Green made a number of prints and showed them to acquaintances in an attempt to get backing for his own expedition to Ararat. According to Ark researcher Errol Cummings, Green wasn't successful and the expedition didn't take place. And later, Green went to British Guiana to work with a mining company. He was murdered there in 1962. Presumably, it was a robbery. His valuables, which may have included the photographs of the Ark, were never located. And although a number of people who stated they'd seen Green's photographs were contacted by Cummings, no copy of any of the photographs was ever located. Well, with the use of space satellites and space shuttles and their detailed inspection of much of the Earth's surface, it could be hoped that some photographs of Mount Ararat would reveal information about the presence of the Ark, especially at the points where the viewers have claimed to have seen it. One photograph taken from space in 1974 by Earth Research Technical Satellite, ERTS, revealed after intensive enlargement an unusual feature on the side of the mountain at the high altitude of 14,000 feet. The ERTS photo was discussed by Senator Frank Moss, then chairman of the Senate Aeronautical and Space Sciences Committee, in a speech made to the Utah section of the American Congress on Surveying and Mapping. He stated that an unusual object in one of the folds of the mountain was about the right size and shape to be the Ark. The section of the mountain photographed was shot at an altitude of 450 to 500 miles, and the area is similar to the type of crevice in the side of the mountain where the Ark and or some other unusual construction has been seen by pilots. But any object seen from that height, as well as being half under the snow or in the shadow of a crevice, would be almost impossible to identify, even under extreme enlargement. One thing is certain, though. Whatever it is not an optical illusion, which can come easily to straining eyes, but not to sophisticated cameras. Future air inspections of Mount Ararat, especially during the late summer melting of the ice, and preferably by helicopter, might reveal the hidden ship in the upper region of the mountain, where a number of people claim to have seen it, approached it, and even some have even touched it. Despite the lack of clear or attainable photographs of the Ark on Mount Ararat, there's already exist numerous photographs of a suspected Ark located within 20 miles of Mount Ararat on another smaller range of mountains. This, what's called the alternate Ark, bears a surprising resemblance to the biblical description of the Ark, and unlike the presumed Ark on Ararat, it can be visited and photographed, provided you have permission. By the relatively simple expedient of taking a taxi from Dugobayatsit to the site on Akiala Range, since its discovery in 1959, and especially after the furor in the press and television within the last few years, it is well known. It's been theorized this alternate arc has either been fossilized so that it blends with the terrain or has been buried by mudslides. To differentiate it from the possible arc on Ararat, it could best be described as the buried ship or arc near the Tenderek Mountains, the subject of a great deal of research and discussion. Now, those who belong to what's called the peoples of the book, that's the Jews, the Christians, and the Muslims, have been conditioned since childhood to the acceptance of the legend of the Ark. And this legend, if legend it be, is more persuasive than some other Old Testament stories, such as Jonah and the whale, the snake in the Garden of Eden, and the extreme age of the Earth's early patriarchs. Because the mountains of Ararat are still there, and for thousands of years, people have been hearing about Noah's Ark. Therefore, almost any unusual feature of the mountain is likely to be associated with the Ark by observers from the air, the plain, or even the nearby hills. And these observers, even if they don't realize it, are psychologically conditioned to believe in its reality. A discovery in 1959 was a result of a routine aerial survey taken near Ararat by the Turkish Air Force. Photographs taken by the pilot, Lieutenant A. Curtis, at a ground altitude of 10,000 feet were sent to headquarters where they were examined by a captain assigned to photo interpretation. One particular photograph caught his attention, unique because it showed a long oval hill, smooth in form in an area where otherwise was marked by crevasses and gullies. The hill-like form seemed to be bounded by a raised ridge. Now, this photograph was taken about 17 miles south of Ararat. As he stared, the captain realized the oval hill was shaped like a ship. Its raised sides seemed to resemble a ship's gunwales, and the prow was pointed toward Tenderek Peaks. The captain wondered what were the dimensions of this strange formation as he remembered the well-known instructions traditionally given by God to Noah. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, the breadth of it 50 cubits, and the height of it 30 cubits. Well, the dimensions of the strange hill measured by Turkish engineers during a two-day survey showed the length of the ark, if such it was, to be 500 feet, the width of the middle 150 feet, and the height of the gunwales 45 feet. These could be said to roughly correspond with the biblical measurements of the ark if we consider that the sides of the ark could have been split during the many intervening centuries while the strong wooden planks of the hull still held their shape. Thus, it would capture mud, slides, stones, lava deposits, and still preserve their contours clearly outlined against the rough terrain around them. Even the height would be increased on one side, as it is in an area known for earth slides, lava streams, and seismic activity, as mud packed together with stones built up against the ship's walls and solidified. But the question comes up, where is the Ark? The first Turkish team found no trace of any construction. If the Ark was there, it was buried underneath its facsimile, which would serve as its tomb. An expedition formed by scientists and searchers from the U.S. under the aegis of Turkish officials, and therefore a Turkish expedition, examined the Ark hillock in the early summer of 1960. Its members included Professor Arthur Brandenberger, photogrammetric specialist from Ohio State College, Dr. Siegfried, an archaeologist from the Chicago Oriental Institute, Rene Norbergen, international correspondent and author, businessman Hal Thompson, and William Bishop, George Vandeman, explorer and researcher, for the Ark and leader of the expedition. Turkish officers Major Mikhail and Captain Durupinar and the air photography interpretation specialist who had originally noticed a phenomenon, and selected officers and men of the 3rd Cavalry Regiment of the Turkish Army. The presence of businessmen or simply believers in the Ark back in the expedition had been the general case in the many subsequent expeditions to the mountain. In this regard, the search for the Ark belongs in a category distinct from other treasure searches. There's no gold or treasure to be found and divided, as in the case of lost Spanish treasure fleets, lost cities in the jungle, treasures from ancient tombs, lost gold and silver mines, or buried pirate treasure. Except for the reported plan of Archbishop Nuri to bring the Ark down from the mountain exhibited at the Chicago World's Fair, the search for the Ark has had primarily a spiritual and secondarily an archaeological motive. When one meets searchers for the Ark, one's impressed by their faith and the strength of their desire to prove the Ark is there. The detailed examinations effected by the expedition verified measurements roughly equivalent to those mentioned in the Bible. Some variations could be allowed for according to the accepted length of the cubit. Also, the somewhat excessive width of the object could be explained by the splitting of the gunwales of the Ark filled with earth and covered by lava and then more earth on top of that. After some discussion among members of the expedition, the decision was reached to dynamite a portion of the supposed Ark to see whether there existed evidence of wood or metal construction underneath. Perhaps they could find remnants of pitch or stout inner timbers in conformity with reports or legendary memories of Noah's Ark. So dynamite charges were placed and exploded by soldiers of the military escort. No inner chamber or clear evidence of beams was discovered. All it was later claimed that bits of decayed wood was found among the debris. Well, it appeared and later was generally accepted the Phantom Ark was simply a natural uplift of the earth in an area of seismic activity. That it was solidified mud or lava, not the Ark or even a cast of the Ark. Nevertheless, the pile of lava and earth bore a surprising resemblance to what one might visualize to be the hull of an ancient ship on the ocean floor. Except here there was no ocean, only the memory of the sea recalled by shells and sea fossils on and under the earth and on the mountain. The simulacrum of the Ark remained relatively unnoticed from 1960 to 84, during which time a number of explorers, mountaineers, and dedicated searchers for the Ark continued their expeditions on Ararat itself. Meanwhile, a number of photographs of the Phantom Ark appeared from time to time in the more sensational weekly newspapers, usually reproducing the Turkish propaganda photograph of 1959, sometimes reinforced with a heavy touching up of the original picture, which was attributed to aerial photos by Turkish and Russian pilots. 1984, the buried Ark enjoyed a resurgence of publicity, widely reported in the world press. This came about as a result of an expedition that visited and inspected the object collected from its specimens of stone, lava, and soil. The team was headed by Marvin Steffens, president of International Explorations, and Ronald Wyatt, an anesthetist who had visited the site in previous years. Upon return to Ankara, Steffens announced the boat-shaped formation was indeed the Ark, and he had taken a number of samples from the formation and had packed them in sacks. These samples consisted of wood, soil, and stones to be analyzed upon his return to the U.S. He had also taken some samples, which he announced he planned to have analyzed in Knoxville, Tennessee. As the removal of any valuable antique, and understated, but I'm sure you would agree, apt description of the Ark, it's likely to provoke a negative response from any national government where the antiques are found. And the Turkish government soon heard about the sacks, intercepted Steffens at the Istanbul airport as he was leaving Turkey. But it wasn't contraband. It was just 8.6 pounds of stone, sand, and earth, innocent enough, but still officially Turkish property. In the meantime, Wyatt had taken his own collection in New York and exhibited it at a press conference. This appropriation of national property elicited considerable press reaction in Turkey. One editorial in the English-language Turkish Times attacked not only the taking of samples, but the lack of consideration by foreigners for the customs and regulations of the nation. They added in a reference to the flood legend, "Without these considerations, we degenerate to the level of uncivilized beings that God sent the flood to the world to destroy." Well, the incident, which interrupted other expeditions on the mountain as well, soon developed as an otherworldly aspect. Colonel Irwin, the famous astronaut who'd walked on the moon, had in his luggage a replica of moon rock he'd collected from the moon's surface. This rock was seized by officials for examination as a possible legal export from Turkey until Colonel Irwin explained it wasn't an archaeological nor of Turkish origin. Indeed, not of this world. A new investigation of the Phantom Ark took place in March of 85. This time, an improved prototype of the molecular frequency scanner was used in order to detect whether there was a bulk shape or metal within the mound. Now, this molecular frequency scanner operates on the same principle as the CAT scanner, used in hospitals to locate and measure foreign growths within the organs of the human body. The scanner was brought to Turkey by David Fasold, a longtime student of the Ark and an enthusiastic believer in its existence, not on top of Ararat, but on a smaller range 18 miles away. Now, Fasold is an expert marine officer with a master's license and an experienced underwater diver and salver who's long worked with side-scanning subsurface radar for identifying underwater wrecks. He's more familiar with the sea than with mountains, but convinced, as he said, that whether underwater or under earth, I know a ship when I see one. Well, Fasold and Wyatt visited the buried Ark in March, fighting their way through the deep snow. Fasold had brought the scanner with him, and he determined to their mutual satisfaction it was a massive bulk or some sort of object under the snow and inside the mound. Indications of iron showed up in traceable lines crisscrossed by the lines of definite intervals. Faced with this information, Wyatt was immediately convinced the Ark had been found, suggested the iron indicated remains of great nails used for fastening beams or maybe the bars of animal cages. Well, when they stopped for food at a gas station restaurant on the way back to Ankara, local bus and truck drivers wanted to know how they came to be so snowburned. Their car driver explained, "These Americans are heroes. They were a machine that's helped them discover the Holy Ark." Well, this somewhat premature statement called forth blessings, free food, and toast of Rocky. Fasold and Wyatt returned to Turkey in June with Dr. John Bumgardner, a NASA research scientist from Los Alamos. This time, uncovered by snow, they identified 9 traverse lines by following the metal dots across 13 long lines that would seemingly outline the hull of a great ship, curved as a ship would be, not box-like, with what would be the keel line bearing 10 degrees north toward Mount Ararat. Well, it was decided Fasold would return to the U.S. to pick up a high-tech interface radar unit used by NASA, rented by him from Geophysical Survey Systems, and bring it back to Turkey. Such a machine would be capable of photographing what the CAT scanner had merely indicated. It could penetrate 50 feet under the surface of the land and could clearly depict what was inside the Ark mound. And special permission, of course, to use this interface radar outside the U.S. had to be obtained from NASA. Permission also had to be granted by the Turkish government for its use inside Turkey. During August, while the team waited for the unit to arrive, they began to re-examine the site. The group now included Wyatt, Bumgardner, Malin Wilson, who brought a core drilling machine, Tom Finner, an exploratory geologist who was to run the interface radar, and George House, the photographer for the expedition. The previous experiment with the CAT scan was repeated, and after a number of probes, a series of ribbons was strung over the Phantom Ark, ostensibly to follow direction lines that indicated concentrations of metal. Orange ribbons were used to determine lines from east to west, and yellow ribbons crisscrossed these, going from north to south. When the ribbons were in place, the outline made the object look more like a ship than ever. Now, some skeptics present have observed that although at some instances the metal detectors weren't turned on, the lines continued to trace the figure of a ship. And these first tests were psychologically aided by Ron Wyatt's running commentary to the press, television crew, and the other observers. At one point, as he walked over the rise between the gunwales, he stated he was standing over the captain's cabin. They'd have made reference to the tracing indicated by the ribbons as indicating iron bars marking the now buried ancient cages for the animals on the Ark. Well, Fasold eventually returned to Dugubayayets with the subsurface interface radar recording unit and the necessary permits. Well, when he got back, he found an air rat in the surrounding area had once more been declared off limits to foreign investigators because terrorists had captured several expeditions on the upper slopes, confiscated their equipment, and chased them off the mountain at gunpoint. Although Turkish commandos soon dispersed and rounded up the insurgents, interdiction on Ark exploration remained. Fasel was therefore unable to operate the machine, but renewed his efforts in the summer of 86. Should be observed that even if the radar recording unit doesn't eventually give positive proof of a varied ship beneath that ship-like mound, a unit could also be used on suspect areas on the mountain itself, as it's equally effective in distinguishing forms, dimension, and details of objects under snow, ice, or water, as well as those buried in the earth. Well, Fasol considers the location of the buried ark, 17 miles from Mount Ararat, is compatible with the Quranic mention of Mount Judi as the resting place of the ark, since Judi in Arabic simply means the heights, and that's also in keeping with the biblical tradition, which doesn't specifically say Mount Ararat, but the mountains of Ararat. Although Tenderek Range is usually given as the site of the ark mound, it's actually on the nearby Akayalo Range that runs northwest and southeast, fairly close to Dugabayazit. The section of hills where the Ark is located is referred to as Masr, which means doomsday, the name reminiscent of events that in the memory of many races took place in the surrounding area. The altitude of the object is 6,300 feet above sea level, considerably lower than that estimated for the Ark on Ararat. But its present level, according to Fasol's theory, is a result of a sudden slide from a greater height than the Akayalo Range, where it had been situated since the flood occurred. The slide down the mountain resulted in it being buried in mud and sand, which by a process of siliconization petrified the great ship and preserved its shape. It might have been stopped in its downward slide by a large rock formation that can still be seen piercing the side of the object or what will be the port side of the ship. This buried ark, according to Fasold, was not noticed before now because it was not at the place where the ark was supposed to be. Since it was sighted from the air, though, earthquakes in the area have caused it to rise and the ground around it to erode away, leaving the ark shape more evident. If the object is effectively proven to be part of a ship, the claim that it's Noah's ark could still be in some doubt. It is interesting to note that many of the local population know of the object, but consider it not to be the ship of Noah, which is up on the mountain, but the ship of Malik Shah, a ruler of ancient times, who used a very large ship on a lake that covered an extensive area around Ararat, which may have been connected with other large bodies of water to the south and the north. It's interesting to note that a lake still exists on the Ararat plain, fed by underground streams from the melting ice coming from the Great and Little Ararat. During 1987, the buried ark was going to be examined. It's planned by Turkish archaeologists as well as by a number of Americans if they can get the necessary permits. Now, since the time it was first discovered, though, our explorers have on one occasion dynamited it or tried to take away pieces of it for testing. So the Turkish authorities are inclined to prohibit digging or dislodging pieces of the buried ship or any other vessel found on the mountains, less like certain other archaeological remains in different countries, they'd be partially or wholly dismantled and smuggled out of the country. But Fasold is convinced that for proving the artifact's identity as a ship, digging into it wouldn't be necessary or even productive, as the artifact itself has changed its molecular composition through siliconization and is now solid. He says, do you know what interface radar is capable of? You could see inside it without demolishing it. You'd be able to see beams and partitions and decks and iron bars perhaps in place. Well, if the buried formation proves to be a large ship, what about the other ark so often reportedly seen on Mount Ararat and believed to be Noah's ark since remote antiquity? Could there have been two arks or even more, considering the Islamic assertion that the ark was on Mount Judi, also in Turkey, but to the south? Another was on Mount Nasir, still another on Mount Dimavand in Iran. Various other landing places of survival ships in different parts of the world may be possible. Nevertheless, its reported presence on Mount Ararat of the Ark of Noah that still holds the belief and imagination of many of the world's people. Its definite location on the mountains where it's supposed to be would be an event that would change the mood of the present world, modifying its religious, historical, geophysical, and even political concepts. This is perhaps why, besides an understandable zeal for knowledge and exploration, so many climbers on the mountain and their desire to find it have faced danger and death, and sometimes finding both. Well, Ararat is certainly one of the world's most impressive and beautiful mountains. Impressive because it rises an abrupt 14,000 feet from the plain, which is already 3,000 feet high. It's beautiful because it stands alone away from other mountains, and when the cloud cover lifts from the summit, often in the early morning and evening, its gigantic mass and snow-covered dome causes one to raise one's head in a sort of involuntary salute to its size, mystery, and connection with mankind's most famous legend. Ararat, with its two peaks of Greater and Lesser Ararat, covers an area of more than 600 square miles. It's a volcano that last erupted in 1840, causing the disappearance of the village and monastery of Aurora on its northeastern side and the formation of a great gorge 800 feet deep where the village used to be. A number of glaciers came down the mountain, of which the Parrot Glacier and the Abich 1 and Abich 2 glaciers are the largest in extent and in places 200 feet thick. Ararat's ice cover covers more than 20 square miles and is thickest in the declivity between the two peaks of Greater Ararat. The sides of the mountain contain a number of gorges in which explorers and pilots at various times have reported seeing what they believe to be the remains of Noah's Ark. Other sites on the mountain suggest other possible resting places for the Ark. They include locations above the new village of Aurora, or points underneath the glacier, or still under the ice at the summit. It's not at present possible to look at the Ark at Aurora because its proximity to the border of Russia. You know, the present favorite departure point for Ark hunting expeditions or climbing parties simply interested in ascending the famous mountain is the town of Dobryazyt, which forms the southern point of an almost equidistant triangle between Greater Ararat to the north and Lesser Ararat to the southeast. The season for Dobryazyt expeditions is short, but it's crowded since only in mid and late summer are climbing conditions, especially the lack of snow at lower levels, favorable to the difficult ascent. At such a time, the climber, in addition to the normal and special difficulties to be expected on Mount Ararat, also encounters a pleasant profusion of mountain flowers, flocks of sheep, horses, goats, friendly shepherds, and most notably, unfriendly dogs. However, there are many dangers connected with explorations of the mountain, some mysterious and others patently obvious, that one can understand the Turkish word for Ararat. Also, Agri Dag, the mountain of pain, is an appropriate description for it. Ahmet Ali Arslan, mountaineer, photographer, artist, writer, and holder of a doctorate from the Erzurum University, was interviewed about the special dangers peculiar to Mount Ararat. He can be considered to be well informed on the subject as he's climbed to the summit of Greater Ararat 17 times out of a total of 37 climbs on the mountain. He was born in Aralik on the north side of Mount Ararat and has been climbing the mountain since 1965. He also had considerable climbing experience on the mountains of the Pamir Range located in Kyrgyzstan, Russia. So he was asked, how do you as an alpinist rate Ararat in comparison with the other mountains you've climbed? He said, technically, the climb is not too difficult. But it's been stated by scientists there is active gas, carbon dioxide, on the upper slopes. And this is in addition to the normal lack of oxygen on extreme heights. This combination is very hard on climbers and causes illness and confusion. He was asked what he thought about the avalanches. He said, snow avalanches are rare except in spring when overhanging snow cliffs can partially melt, attach themselves, and crash down. And this happens principally on the northeast and northwest sides. But the rock slides, like rock avalanches, are worse. Volcanic bombs, rocks, and solidified lava frozen near the crater roll down the mountain. Some are as big as trucks and with a velocity of 80 to 125 miles an hour. Now, sometimes a rock slide can be started by the jumping of wild goats frightened by climbers, or a shouted command, an echo, or a shot from a rifle. It's just like the snow avalanches on the Swiss Alps, except that here it's thousands and thousands of rocks. When he was asked, is weather a danger? He said, severe rainstorms and snowstorms can catch you unexpectedly on the mountain. The worst parts of a storm are the bolts of lightning which have struck and immobilized climbers. Well, he was asked, didn't this happen on other mountains as well? And he said, yes, but not like on Ararat. This is a lone and very high mountain, so it's like a gigantic lightning rod. The upper slopes are usually covered with clouds full of static electricity, and climbers carry a lot of metal equipment, picks and crampons and pitons and etc. The metal pins on mountaineers' hats, which we use for trading with other climbers, you can kind of attract a lightning bolt. The rocks you might try to hide behind are also dangerous. If you're looking for shelter, try to find lava rock. The sharp granite rocks actually attract lightning. He was asked, when you're in the clouds, do you lose your way? And he said, no, you stop. If you continue, you could step over the side of a gorge or break through the partially melted ice crust into a crevasse going deep down into a great glacier. He said, I think that's what happened to two female climbers who disappeared on the mountain in 1985. Remember, you don't know where these holes are. The mountain itself is a volcano and it's still hot. The fog seems to start when hot puffs of gas come from vents in the mountain. When you pinch your tent at a camp after a while, you can notice the earth is giving off heat. 1965, we had an earthquake here. Just the people going into the mosque at the time of prayer, they heard a deep, powerful roaring sound that came from inside the earth, and after that, the earth shook. Well, he was asked, I seem to remember that the animal life on Ararat is dangerous to climbers and could be divided into zones. The lowest zone for poisonous vipers, the zone for wolves, and finally the zone for bears. Do you agree? And he said, yes, and don't forget the scorpions when you make camp at the lower levels. They're apt to get under your blanket, sometimes dozens of them, attracted by the heat. If you have a bad heart, a bite or several bites can kill you. As for the other kinds of wildlife, the wolves that normally hunt the grazing sheep will attack men if they're hungry enough, and the bears are dangerous if they think you're threatening them. Well, on one climb, I started to go for shelter into one of the caves on the mountain, but found a mother bear and two cubs already in possession of it. I looked for another cave. He was asked, are there bandits or terrorists on the mountain? He said, I never saw any. Been a number of reports published in the newspapers about them during the summer of 85, but Turkish Army Commando unit swept the mountain from the top down in August, and you can be sure there are no bandits there now. He said, what Turkish expressions are the most useful for travelers on the mountain? He said, well, there are a few. Hello is merhaba. Please hold your dogs. Lütfen, kopegi, tutun. There's, frankly, a laundry list of Turkish expressions. Well, he was asked, you've had extensive experience as a guide on Mount Ararat, and you're an authority on history and folklore. Is the Ark on Ararat? He said, I believe enough people have seen it within the last 50 or 60 years to establish the truth of the legend. It'd probably be found right where it's supposed to be, between 14,000 and 15,000 feet up, following the right-hand side of the Aurora Gorge right up to the front of the Parrot Glacier. There's a huge plateau there, big as a football field, 100 yards deep in ice. This is where, during melting periods, the Ark has been seen and pieces of it have been taken away, and this is where the remains of the Ark will be found. Nevertheless, although there exists a general belief, the Ark is frozen under the glacier within an ice field over the Aurora Gorge. Any expedition formed to dig down to it or remove it would run into several disadvantages. In the first place, the Aurora Gorge faces the Russian frontier, where military observers are quick to question any noticeable activity on the Turkish side, and if accomplished by Americans, and an official protest to be sure to follow. Any search for the Ark in the area where many investigators believe the remnants of the great ship would lie would have to be done quickly and during the summer heat. If the Ark had been reported as located at a certain place, why not have exploratory parties follow up on the find? Well, the answer to this was furnished by the explicit accounts from ancient times, which took thousands of years to be verified as true. To this category belong the cities of Troy, reputed to be contained in a certain great mound, which, when finally excavated, did effectively reveal them. The metropoli of ancient Mesopotamia, covered by mounds extending under the desert, which had been rediscovered only by reports from Arab tribes that great mounds were a good place to find bricks. And the complete cities of Herculaneum and Pompeii, buried and forgotten for 1,500 years and thought to be legends. With most of Herculaneum still unexcavated, since an Italian town, Racina, has been built over the earth covering the ruins. To these examples should be added the Great Sphinx of Giza, whose front paws were suspected to exist and to contain a stone altar, but for almost 2,000 years nobody took the trouble to dig down between the paws and see whether it was true. When they finally did, the legend was found to be true. There is an altar. In other words, all that's needed is a well-organized expedition equipped with permits, digging implements, and subsurface radar to test for the presence and maybe find the Ark on Ararat. Experiences undergone by expeditions or individuals on Ararat underscore the dangers and suggest a few more. John Morris, the son of Henry Morris, Ark researcher and prominent in the creationist movement, organized an expedition to Mount Ararat in 1972. He subsequently wrote his own book, Adventure on Ararat, in which he describes in vivid terms his encounter with bolt lightning at an elevation of 13,000 feet. He observed the lightning seemed to be collecting in certain spots, accompanied by tremendous explosions of thunder. He said static electricity was evident everywhere. Our ice axes and crampons were singing, our hair was standing on end, even JB's beard and my mustache were sticking straight out. Well, despite the storm, Morris and two others of his party continued upward and at one point sat under a large rock to rest. Suddenly that rock was repeatedly struck by lightning, knocking Morris and another climber down the slope and freezing Bultima, that's the JB I mentioned earlier, to the rock with arms and legs extended out into the air. While stuck to the rock, he could feel the electricity surging through his body, almost completely paralyzing his movements. When he finally was able to force one foot to the ground, he unintentionally completed the electrical current, causing the force to throw him down the slope where the others had fallen. Morris, who had lost consciousness from the electric shock, never regained it, but still couldn't move. He saw the third member of the group covered with blood from encountering the sharp rocks. He seemed to be unaware of what had happened and asked, why don't we go sit under that big rock and get out of this snow, indicating the same rock where they had been sitting when they were hit by lightning. Gradually, they were able to recover their mobility, probably due to their conditioning as well as the psychological force from prayer, and continue painfully back down the mountain. Well, the 1965 disappearance of young British mountaineer Christopher Tees is especially notable as it serves as a warning not to go climbing alone. Tees, who was a Balliol student and modestly supported by research grants from Oxford and Balliol College, arrived in Dugubayazit, equipped with iron rations, which he planned personally to carry up the mountain, but with little else. With extraordinary optimism, he planned to climb to the top of Ararat by August 26th and on the summit celebrate his birthday. When he didn't arrive back in London as he had planned, by September 14th, his family had been making inquiries through the British Embassy in Ankara, which instituted a search involving the Turkish Third Army, the Gendarme, the local police, and the border police. An official British party, carried by Land Rover, investigated his disappearance in Agra and Dugubayazit, frequently showing photographs of Tees to local inhabitants to see if anybody recognized him. Two guides who said they had seen him at a tea shop in the town were able to speak with him through a student of English from Agra, reported an offer to guide him, but he refused their offer since he wished to climb the mountain alone. His last seen leaving Dugubayazit on foot on his way to climb the mountain, carrying his own pack, no guide, pack horse or donkey, or even an ice axe. Well, despite a liberal reward offered by his parents for information, the only report from the British investigative party was that a Kurdish camp on the mountain had been visited by Tees and that the Kurds had offered him a horse. It was later found the horse had bolted, scattering what equipment he did have. It was thought that Tees might have decided to go back to go by Yazit and disappeared on his return trip. Well, a subsequent expedition organized by Tees' parents to the Oxford University Explorers Club was equally unsuccessful, concluded the remains of Tees might be concealed in a crevasse on a boulder slope. And a curious incident occurred while the expedition was in camp. Shepard approached the camp and asked for the correct time so he could set his watch, a gold-plated wristwatch with silver expanded bracelet, something of a rarity among shepherds. According to his parents, Tees had been wearing a watch of this description when he left on his trip to climb the mountain. And Colonel James Irwin, the astronaut who walked on the moon, founded an organization in 1972 appropriately called High Flight, an international church foundation dedicated in part to the finding of the Ark on the Mount Ararat. On his 1982 expedition, Colonel Irwin, after reaching the summit, separated from his climbing party for the purpose of returning to base camp to plan the descent. He wrote a book called More Than an Ark on Ararat, and what described what happened to him on the way down. While taking a shortcut across a snowfield at about 12,500 feet, he sat down to put on his crampons and suddenly lost consciousness, evidently struck on the back of the head by a rock bouncing down the mountain. Well, he regained consciousness to find himself at the bottom of the snowfield on a pile of rocks, bleeding from many cuts and suffering sprains, a possible concussion, and 5 broken teeth. As night came with it, an intense cold, he was able to, with difficulty, to get onto his, into his sleeping bag, but when he fell asleep, he would slide further down the mountain. Despite his condition, he'd have to pull it back up to the cover of a protective rock. After passing a night of suffering, the extreme cold, covered with blood from his cuts, he was contacted by a rescue party and taken by ambulance and helicopter to a hospital in Erzurum. Now, the fall hadn't discouraged him. He's taken further expeditions up Ararat in each succeeding year, and in his words, the Ark will be sought year after year. It's a mystery that'll live on until it's rediscovered. Irwin attributes his 1982 escape and return to health to his faith and deep religious commitment. Referring to his own lunar experience, he makes a moving comment. God walking on the earth is more important than man walking on the moon. Interesting concept. During the years 1954 to 69, John Leiby, a resolute searcher for the Ark, made a total of 8 research expeditions up Ararat, the last one when he was 73 years old. Leiby's of Bulgarian origin and of strong religious belief, and he was convinced that he knew where to find the Ark as he'd seen its location in a dream. His climbs on the mountain were not uneventful. He was chased by bears, one of which he reported threw stones at him and was menaced by mountain lions. Now, question if a bear can throw a rock. He was injured when he fell 30 feet onto a rock ledge, was pelted by icy hail as big as tennis balls, buried in snow up to his neck, and developed pneumonia. On one extensive expedition, sudden torrents of rain washed his supplies and equipment down the mountain. A member of his group disappeared over a cliff when the footing at the edge, loosened by an earthquake, collapsed. An Austrian doctor joined his group during the climb, left camp for a walk, and was never seen again. In his final trip, John Leiby reached the point where his dream showed him the Ark would be sitting, but it wasn't there. In August of 1936, a New Zealand archaeologist, also a British agent, J. Hardwick Knight approached Ararat from the southeast, crossing the river at the Turkish border south of Sadarak. His crossing was made in some haste, in order, in his own words, to escape from embarrassing followers who had been pursuing him in Persia, which was what we know as Iran. Having crossed the Turkish frontier, he intended to circle the slopes of Ararat until he'd get to Ekmeyadizan. When he approached the camp on the mountains, he was suddenly taken prisoner by horsemen who then gave him a mount. They took him northward to their headquarters and kept him there for 2 days alone in a cellar. Since no horseman would speak to him or allow him to speak, he couldn't tell them who he was or who they were and why they were keeping him prisoner. The end of the second day, they took him away from headquarters and freed him on foot on the mountain. Since the area was covered by fog, he couldn't form an idea where he was, but he proceeded westward, hoping to reach the northern face. As he traveled, he encountered explosive electric storms and winds he thought to be up to 100 miles an hour in force. In shock, half asleep, proceeding by instinct, he eventually passed by a series of timbers protruding from the snow near the rim of the Aurora Gorge. His first thought was they were the remains of artillery carriages or even parts of a large barn, although this latter possibility is unlikely at such a height, especially as there are no trees or record of trees on the upper slopes. He did break off a piece of the wood, which was soggy and disintegrating, and which he later lost. Finally, he arrived at Barry. Only later did the idea strike him he might have walked past Noah's Ark. And from then on, he regretted the circumstances, hadn't permitted a more detailed examination of the timbers he'd passed in such haste. He thought more and more about the Ark, and in 1967 went back to Ararat as part of an expedition to investigate the area where he remembered seeing the series of beams. He wasn't successful because the beams were either buried under snow or had slipped further down the mountain, maybe into the Aurora Gorge. Now, Mount Ararat's located within a military zone and has frequently been closed to climbers for reasons of security. A period of off-limits was lifted in 1982. This applied, however, only to the southwest side, since the northeast side is uncomfortably close to Russia, and the southeast side is close to the border of Iran. In 1984, a full-page illustrated article encouraging travel to Mount Ararat appeared in the travel section of the New York Times. That was Sunday, February 19, 1984. It gave going rates for transportation to and the hotels in Dolgobayazit, recommending one for the view and another for the food, as well as giving particulars about how to get there and the end season for mountain climbing. The writer even specified the man to contact in Dolgobayazit. Ahmet Aga gave his telephone number and reported that he bought the title to the southwest slope of Mount Ararat 10 years ago for about $22,000, and he wouldn't sell it for $4 million today. Now, this later statement's probably a mistranslation, as no one is permitted to own any part of that mountain. He rents the property from the Turkish government. And according to Ahmet Aga, it said he knew the whole mountain, not that he owned it. Among expeditions organized after 1982 and the ban that was placed on climbing were several conducted by Colonel Irwin, and in 1985 at least four foreign expeditions attempted ascents to the mountains during July and early August. The groups are from Japan, Germany, France, and the U.S., with the last three groups on the mountain at practically the same time. The American group, a religious one, was the most ark-oriented, although it was certain the other groups would examine any wood found on that treeless mountain with considerable interest. All four groups were captured at night while in their various camps with members of local dissident groups infesting the mountains. The Japanese climbers were the first victims, seized, briefly held, and sent down the mountain after being divested of their cameras and special equipment. The American group from the Probe Ministries Foundation under the combined leadership of Bill Krause of Dallas and John McIntosh of Crestline, California, had learned about the Japanese incident, but having gotten permission and hearing the mountain was officially reopened, made the climb anyway. A Turkish commando unit accompanied him in the first 7,000 feet and then returned. Other climbers in the group included Jay Bitzer from Dallas, the expedition photographer, Greg Cromadia from Dallas, Wayne Mitchell of Bound Brook, New Jersey, and Garen Miyoski of Toledo, all capable mountaineers. On the third day, having reached the 13,500-foot level in the snow line, the probe group made a camp prior to the final push. They were awakened at midnight by shouting. When co-leader Krause opened his tent flap to see what was happening, he was looking at the muzzle of a Soviet AK-47 held by a stranger named at his face. Well, the intruders, who seemed to number about eight, confiscated the cold weather gear necessary for attaining the summit, started a fire with what was burnable, and forced their captives to move quickly down the mountain until they got to the 10,000-foot level where the German group had already been intercepted, held, and chased down the mountain. Jay Bitzer remembers the terrorists confiscated all cameras and packed extra gear into rucksacks, forcing the captives to travel down the mountain in the extreme cold without wearing their cold weather gear. Whenever they hesitated, they were urged on by the terrorists and their excitedly held AK-47s. The captors seemed to be in communication with other individuals or bands on the mountain. Bitzer stated they treated each group differently. The French team had to lie on the ground for half an hour. John McIntosh later learned that some of the non-American team members received a more definite discouragement from making future attempts on Ararat. They had their hands tied behind them. They were drugged and struck and finally made their way down the mountain at night, clad only in their winter underwear. McIntosh thinks the American team members were treated better because they had established friendly relationships with the Kurd horsemen who acted as a buffer between the kidnappers and their captives. McIntosh, a young and agile Californian, has already participated in several climbs up Ararat. He's convinced that the presence of the Ark on some part of the mountain is real, maybe hidden under the snow and ice of the glaciers. And he remembers a series of incidents in the capture. He said, the people raided our camp, tore down our tents, took what equipment they thought they would need, then they poured our cooking gas on equipment they didn't want and set it on fire. They kept us around the fire and held us there while part of them burned and looted the French camp below us. Then they took us past the French camp to the German camp, what we call the Green Camp, past the grass line. There were more terrorists there, and for a moment I thought we seemed about to participate in a town meeting. They had made a number of comments to us from the time we were first captured, most of which I didn't understand, but some of which was clear. That Carter was okay, that Reagan was definitely no good, and that by a gesture we had offended them by climbing their mountain. Well, since they started pushing them around and pointing guns at them, indicating we should stand in a straight line, they didn't know what was going to happen, but when he saw them bringing their guns to shoulder level, he thought they were going to be shot. Then when they were lined up to their satisfaction, they lowered the guns, produced cameras, started taking flash pictures. After this, their leader, who Bill Krause said looked just like Joe Stalin, pointed down the mountain and toward Dolgobayazit and said, go quick, back to America. I didn't even understand what he said, whether he said it in English or Turkish, but we certainly got the meaning. They didn't want him to ever come back to the mountain. Well, the guides had been standing around occasionally making covert gestures of reassurance, shepherded them back down the mountain, the fastest they'd ever descended, and the first thing they did on reaching Dolgobayazit was to drink a lot of Pepsi, even though it was warm. They were certainly dehydrated. Well, McIntosh, who was undaunted by the experience, climbed the mountain again several weeks later with Colonel Irwin's 1985 expedition. The dissident tribesmen had been swept off the mountain by Turkish commandos, and Turkish troops accompanied the new expedition. The summit was reached, but the party was forbidden to search the ice fields between the two summit peaks, and they returned to base. Well, we've come to the end of tonight's show. We'll be back tomorrow night and talk more about Noah's Ark. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.